is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. We got a ton of stuff to go through today, from over 1 million votes, what should be the progressive agenda, to the five worst Republican lies about income inequality, to 486% interest on loans in New Mexico, to Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Boehner, and is John Boehner guilty of sedition? But which we will be getting into as we go through the day. However, to kick off our show, America's lawyer is with us, Mike Papantonio, author, host of Ring of Fire Radio, and an attorney, ringoffireradio.com, the website. Hey, Pap, how you doing?
Tom, let me add to your list.
Okay.
What have you followed this Dershowitz story?
Yeah, I've got this electronic intifada story in front of me, and the headline is "How Alan Dershowitz Bullied Rape Victims to Protect a Serial Child Molester." I confess I'm not well informed on this, other than having seen the random headlines here and there. What's going on?
Most people are not. Friends of mine, attorneys of mine down in South Florida are involved with this. Let me give you the facts. Dershowitz, the same freak who once expressed his opinion that children were fair game for Israeli missiles, well, he apparently sides up with others who believe that children are also fair game for sexual exploitation. Listen to these facts, Tom. Dershowitz was the lawyer who negotiated a closed room secret deal for child predator Jeffrey Epstein, who had reams of evidence stacked up against him, sharing child sex ring slavery in participation. I mean, that's what this is about.
If I may interrupt, this is one of the things that has made this so big is that one of these women, one of these victims, has come forward in other court papers in another lawsuit and named Prince Andrew as one of the people that she was pimped out to when she was 16 years old or 17.
That's exactly right. Well, it's even more involved than that. In absolute secret, Tom, this is absolute secret, unheard of in this kind of situation. Dershowitz negotiated a deal that forgave multi-billionaire Jeff Epstein for procuring sex with about 40 children, some of them as old as 12 years old. They were children. Some were trafficked, Tom, from other countries. The deal that was made allowed Epstein to serve 13 months in a special private wing of Palm Beach Jail, where he was allowed to leave every day for up to 16 hours. Basically, he only slept there. Now, the same thing would have carried the possibility of life imprisonment for anybody else. So Dershowitz and England's Prince Andrew, as you pointed out, were also accused of participating in sex with the children at Epstein's home. Because of that, and by the way, they've both, of course, denied it, but because of that plea that Dershowitz worked out, what's happened now is there's more suspicion on what's going on here, because the plea specified that any other co-conspirator who might down the road be discovered as being part of this would have total criminal immunity for any involvement. Now, why is that important for Dershowitz? Well, Epstein's private pilot, Larry Visoki, I think is his name, he came forward and he said that he had flown Bill Clinton and he had flown Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak around on the same jets at the same time that some of these same underage girls were on Epstein's jet. So a friend of mine.
Barack and Bill Clinton with.
Yes.
Why are the Republicans not jumping all over this one?
Exactly. Well, let me tell you, it's so interesting because the guys bringing this lawsuit are very, very credible lawyers. They're friends of mine, have been for a long time down in South Florida. They are a powerhouse. They're demanding that the case be reopened because of this disgusting plea deal that was violated, and it violated there's something called the Crime Victims Rights Act, Tom. And what it means is when a plea deal is made with somebody like a child predator, like Epstein, that the victims have to be informed what the deal is. And victims would never say, yeah, let's just put him in a county jail for 13 months where all he does is sleeps there. But mainstream press has given all the players here this fascinating pass. There's underreporting, under investigation that's allowed at least one child sex predator, Epstein, to create their own special justice standard that ignores the fact that anybody besides a billionaire would be in prison for life to run in a children's sex trafficking ring. But you know what, Tom? There's another feature to it. It even gets worse, if you can imagine. The other feature is Dershowitz publicly attacked my friend's law firm, Matt Weising. And when I tell you these guys are major players, they are major players. This law firm basically, they said that this was being fabricated, this was all made up, that Matt Weising, my friend and partner for so long, that they were making this up, that he was an ambulance chaser. So Weising's firm, very interesting, sued Dershowitz for slander. Now, Weising is going to be permitted to take discovery that the feds and state court prosecutors completely failed to do, or if they did it, they covered it up. It's clear that Dershowitz has been accused of making trips to Epstein's mansion. Now, this is where it really gets ugly. We know this. This is unrefuted. Dershowitz has been accused of making trips to Epstein's mansion in Florida during a time when the children were coming and going. A house attendant actually uncovered a journal that showed all of that. But when the house attendant, who was a whistleblower, came forward with the info, he was prosecuted for attempted extortion. That's how crazy this story is. So tonight, I think I'm scheduled to do a program with you tonight.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this on TV tonight, too.
We're going to have new pleadings that were filed about an hour and a half ago.
Whoa.
And it even blows up some new stuff. Epstein's team also ordered private investigations by the truckload to harass and threaten and offer money to families in exchange for non-cooperation with the investigation. Tom, it's my opinion, Dershowitz has stepped into it. He's moved in some dangerous territory with his effort to attack and discredit the Weising firm down in South Florida. And the case against him is going to continue to grow. My call is this has potential to be the Bill Cosby story on steroids. That's how ugly this thing is.
Wow.
It's just begun.
Now, I saw Dershowitz on TV basically saying, you know, this is true. This is not true. I had nothing to do
of
with
course.
This. And not only that, I'm going to sue anybody who even basically talks about this. Are you or I at legal risk for even discussing this? And I wonder how many reporters are asking that question of themselves.
This is all over the place. This is in The Guardian. It's reported.
Well, the British press is all over it. But, I haven't seen the American press much talk about it.
Yeah, Dershowitz has denied it. That's fine. He has the right to deny it. We don't know, but at this point, these are the facts.
Right.
And maybe it'll come through that all of this doesn't mean anything, but when you see the new pleadings that have been filed within about the last hour and a half, it's going to raise some new questions that we'll be able to talk about tonight. I'll send them to you.
That should be fascinating. So we have a little less than a minute, Pep. Where does this go? I mean, is there going to be some remedy for the women involved?
Well, there needs to be. The real thing that has to happen is the investigation of the judges and the prosecutors that were involved. We need to understand Yes, they are. One of the judges is still sitting on the bench down there in South Florida. So the question has to become, what happened here? The big names that were involved thrown around here, that might have been the factor. We don't know. But we do know that when you work out an immunity clause in a plea agreement for anybody who might be a co-conspirator in the future, you got to wonder about that, because these kids are just now coming of age.
Yeah, you know, this is like Jerry Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon, only for something arguably worse. Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, author and host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com. Check it out every weekend. You can get it any day. Pat, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always great talking with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ring of Fire Radio, one of the best programs on the radio. Check it out. And the Twitter is at Mike Papantonio, at Ring of Fire Radio, and at Levin Papantonio. Pap, you're still with us, right?
I'm still here, Tom.
Okay, so on Free Speech TV, Every weekend, you got Ring of Fire TV. What's coming up this Sunday at noon,
well,
Eastern time?
We have author Thomas Frank is going to be here to explain the myth of the center, why Democrats need to avoid moving towards this non-existent area of politics that they keep talking about. It doesn't exist. Howard Nation is going to tell us why the biggest corporations in America are paying their CEOs more than they pay in taxes. Michael Berg is going to tell us how wage theft from employers is undermining the momentum of minimum wage increases. David Dussel, he's going to join us and talk about how Democrats are joining up with Wall Street to destroy public workers' pension. And Farron Cousins is going to be holding a roundtable discussion about the biggest environmental issues of the day, including the truth about the XL pipeline, Obama's energy policies, and why close to 98% of fossil fuels will have to stay in the ground in order to prevent a 2-degree temperature rise that would be catastrophic for this planet.
Sounds like a hell of a show.
Interesting. Yeah, I think it's a pretty interesting lineup.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm following what you're doing on the environment. Tom, thank you for being out there. My God, there's just so few that jump into it like you do, and you are in this fight, and I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your kind words. I'm curious your thoughts on this John Boehner inviting Bibi Netanyahu to speak before the United States Congress. Yeah. It seems at the very least that this is more disrespectful of the president than shouting "you lie" during the State of the Union address.
Well, what it is, Tom, is we're going to see the GOP trying to churn up war. This is the guy who's very good at churning up war. Netanyahu's going to come in. He's going to churn up war against Iran. Republicans do better when they are involved in a war. 2016's coming up. They want to put that discussion on the table. War, we're going to be, I promise you, they'll do everything they can to have us involved in war before 2016 gets here, because that's when they flourish. That's what they are. So Netanyahu is simply a war hawk. He's the perfect voice for all this. So Boehner's going to have him churning up this beat of drums for war.
Yeah.
And it's no surprise. Can you imagine having a Republican president with this Congress and Senate? It would be terrifying.
Right. Shano found a website, I can't vouch for its veracity, that said that roughly 90% of Netanyahu's campaign finance money for his reelection, which is coming up in 2 months, is coming from the United States. So, you know, are we looking at like the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, where, you know, John Boehner is helping to influence an Israeli election?
If you're asking, is there enough there for somebody who would be willing to do something from a prosecution standpoint? Absolutely. For hearings, absolutely. But will it happen? Probably not. The best thing that could happen is to have the media outraged by this, which they won't be. The media loves a good war. And so they're not going to tell the story about whether or not this does move into areas like you're suggesting.
Well, I'm going to push it tonight as my daily take, and I think it's viable. Yeah, it's startling how frequently the stuff that I do on the evening TV show shows up the next day or the day after in almost identical form on certain other networks. So we'll see. Maybe we can push something out. America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, Ring of Fire TV, right here on Free Speech TV. Thank you, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
Always great seeing you. We'll be back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, today is the, how many years anniversary? Anybody know? Today is the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, in any case. And I have some problems with Roe v. Wade. My problems with Roe v. Wade have to do with the Supreme Court. I have no problem with them saying that Jane Roe had every right to get an abortion. That is the appellate function, of the Supreme Court, to say, okay, all these other courts have, you know, disagreed here and there and everywhere else, and we'll make the final decision. I don't think that the Supreme Court has the authority to identify three trimesters and have different rules for prosecution or non-prosecution of people for having abortions during those three trimesters. That is the job of the legislature. The Supreme Court has no authority in the Constitution to make law. So while I am in support of the spirit of the Roe v. Wade decision, and I believe that women should have the right to make to have an abortion of a non-viable fetus, I have some concerns about how it happened, but that's almost nuance. You know, the thing that really concerns me is that now we've got Republicans coming along. Today they were going to pass this piece of legislation through the House of Representatives that basically said no abortions after 20 weeks, the so-called fetal pain bill, is at 20 weeks. If you poke a fetus with a needle, it'll react. Which doesn't mean it's thinking. It means that there's a central nervous system evolving that, you know, is almost certainly no cognitive process involved, no self-awareness, but, you know, tadpoles react to pain. So in any case, they want to pass this so-called fetal pain bill, but they did not want there to be exceptions for rape or incest if the woman who was raped or the victim of incest did not report it to the police. And that was a bridge too far for a couple of women Republicans. And they revolted yesterday in a private meeting with the House of Representatives caucus. They revolted and said, we're not going to support this. And so John Boehner had to pull the bill. So they're going to lay, you know, today is the big anniversary. There's, you know, the Right to Life March. There's going to be people here in Washington, D.C., blah, blah. It's the anniversary of Roe. So the Republicans have to do something. So they're going to pass a watered-down anti-abortion bill. But the consequential thing about this is how Republicans, what has been at the state house, I predict within a year or two, now that the Republicans control the House and the Senate, you are probably going to see, unless the women in the House continue to hold out, we'll see, the Republican women, you are going to see these so-called personhood bills. A personhood bill suggests that at the moment of fertilization, which happens in the fallopian tubes, right, the sperm, sometime typically 2 or 3 days after intercourse. Here we are, birds and bees, and I'll do this hopefully in a way that you don't have to cover the ears of your 7-year-old. 2 or 3 days after mommy and daddy get together, the sperm works its way up into the fallopian tubes, meets an egg, and fertilizes the egg. And then it takes a day or so for the, if I'm remembering my sex ed right, for the egg to work its way back down into the uterus, where it implants into the wall of the uterus and begins establishing the placenta, and then you know, begins to grow. According to these personhood bills, even before the implantation into the placenta happens, that's a person. That fertilized egg is a person. Well, you know, depending on whose statistics you're looking at, and I'm talking, you know, good science, somewhere between a third and two-thirds of all fertilized eggs fail to implant, just randomly. In addition, one out of four pregnancies ends in a miscarriage. And in fact, you know, Louise and I had a miscarriage. It was devastating to her, and it was. You know, I don't want to go into a whole bunch of private stuff, but you know, I've seen this, and the personhood bills would require a woman who has a miscarriage to present herself to the police department, because a miscarriage, if it was induced, if it was caused because mom was smoking crack, or if it was caused because mom took an abortifacient drug or an overdose of birth control pills, or if it was induced because mom, intentionally fell down the stairs or punched herself in the stomach or did any of the other things that women have done throughout history to try to induce an abortion, if that was what caused the miscarriage, then that woman is guilty of murder. And there is one country that actually has a personhood bill that the Republicans are the big champions of, and that's El Salvador. Very Catholic country, very right-wing country. And here's this story, Leslie Salzio writing over at the Daily Kos. She's quoting Tim Rogers at Fusion.net. All forms of abortion are illegal in El Salvador, although there was no indication that Guadalupe, this is her name, young woman in El Salvador by the alias of Guadalupe, had high hopes that she would all but be assured of receiving a pardon from her 30-year prison sentence last week. She's already been in prison for 7 years. Her crime? She had a miscarriage. There was no indication that Guadalupe, a mother of one, intentionally terminated her pregnancy. The doctors snitched her out to save themselves from any criminal liability. Guadalupe, who never saw the inside of a fifth-grade classroom, was interrogated in her hospital bed without a lawyer. The Kafka-esque trial was brutal and swift, and before she knew what was happening, she was sentenced to 30 years in jail and thrown behind bars with convicted murderers. If Guadalupe's story sounds crazy, that's because it is. Not only does El Salvador have one of the most draconian anti-abortion laws in the world, but authorities there apply the tyrannical law with an aggressiveness that borders on the obsessive. Dozens of Salvadoran women, mostly young and poor, are behind bars.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Yeah, this is where we're going in the United States. As soon as you become pregnant, you are a potential criminal. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very down, gyridly ugly, the good, the American people. You heard me, the American people. According to a new poll conducted by the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, PCCC, a majority of Americans, just over half in fact, support having a single-payer health care system. Although it looks like single-payer is dead for now in Vermont, this new poll is a very good sign. Americans want real health care reform, and it's just a matter of if politicians have the courage to fight for it. The bad. Steve Doocy. During a recent episode of Fox and Friends, the Fox so-called news host tried to attack President Obama's plan to provide free community college for eligible Americans by saying that he, who, by the way, is a multimillionaire, just finished paying off his own student loans. Check it out.
Here's the thing that really bothers me about this.
What?
I made my final two college tuition payments about 2 weeks ago.
Well, you're speaking like from the heart of a dad, and moms out there are feeling the same way. Wait a second. Now we're paying for more college tuition for somebody else to the tune of $60 billion.
What a great deal, but who's going to pay for that?
All right, Steve, because when one person is a victim of a terrible policy, everyone should have to suffer under that same bad policy. Makes total Fox sense. And the very, very ugly, Lutz Bachmann. One of the leaders of Germany's emerging anti-Muslim movement is under fire this week after a picture surfaced on the internet of him dressed as Hitler. Bachmann, who started a group called Pegida, or Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamization of the Occident, claims that the picture is just a joke. But let's be honest, if you're the leader of a German hate group and you dress up like Hitler, whether it's a joke or not, it does not look good. Bachmann resigned from his post at Pegida earlier yesterday, but that doesn't change the fact that this is just very, very ugly. So, anyway, this is the story of Guadalupe, which I kind of ran out of time yesterday as I was running into it. But at least let me just finish this out, and then I'll pick up your phone calls. Frankly, wasn't planning on doing abortion as our first hour here, but it's like this is the new Republican rant, right? I mean, you've got to be anti-abortion if you're a Republican. The question is, I think everybody is anti-abortion if we're talking about gratuitously aborting a viable fetus. You know, if a woman is in her seventh, maybe sixth, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a doctor and I'm not an expert on this. But if she's in the seventh, eighth, ninth month of her pregnancy and she just decides, gee, you know, I don't want this thing, and goes in and has it aborted. Well, first of all, that's illegal, at least in the seventh, eighth, ninth month, pretty much everywhere to do that from Roe v. Wade. Right. The third trimester, you have to have, you know, it has to be the life of the mother or the life of the fetus is at risk. There has to be a medical reason. But and so even Roe v. Wade is, quote, opposed to abortion. But this is a serious, tough decision that women make that should not be the province of male lawmakers, or for that matter, male pundits and talk show hosts. It should be between a woman, her physician, or her spiritual advisor if she chooses to have one, her family if she chooses to discuss it with them. We, by passing these laws, other than, you know, I'll carve this out, you know, other than with regard to a viable fetus. And keep in mind, I mean, back, you know, the Bible basically says that you're a human being when you draw your first breath. Right? This goes back to Genesis, and the Catholic policy up until just a few hundred years ago was, and in fact, the Catholic Church used to teach how to do abortions, or used to write about how to do abortions using certain herbs and things and early pregnancy, because, you know, the breath of life, inspiration, that's when the Holy Spirit enters you, is when you take your first breath. It used to be the old, but, you know, obviously that's, you know, modern science marches on. But this is these 29 women behind bars in El Salvador for having miscarriages. A group of them called the hashtag is LAS17, Lost 17, are serving between 12 and 40 years. The oldest among them is 29 years old. The Center for Reproductive Rights has done some good stuff and some good video on this. And here it is happening in the United States. Currently, at least 38 U.S. states have fetal homicide laws. Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, Nebraska, Nevada, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Virginia, Washington State, and West Virginia and Wisconsin. At least 23 states have fetal homicide laws that apply to the earliest stages of pregnancy. Now, you know, personally, I think that the debate about whether two cells, you know, a fertilized ovum, or 10, or, you know, actually it's always multiples of two or powers of two, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64 cells constitutes a human being. In my opinion, it doesn't. It constitutes a potential human being, and there's a difference between, you know, current and potential. But that's just my opinion, and I would not seek to impose my opinion on anyone, woman. I mean, if a woman believes that abortion at any stage in a pregnancy is wrong, she should not have an abortion. She should not get herself an abortion. I mean, it's that simple. But the bigger picture here, from my point of view, is that by engaging in the legislative process with this stuff, we are infantilizing women. We're essentially saying, and all of our legislatures are male-dominated. There is no female-dominated legislature, to the best of my knowledge, anywhere in the United States in terms of federal or state legislatures. So male legislators are infantilizing women. They're treating them like they don't have the ability to make up their own mind. And I think that that's just wrong. Anyhow. Kelda and Madison, you wanted to correct something I said.
Yes, it's very rare that you make an error, Tom. But when you were talking about women being forced to present at the police if they have a miscarriage, you said, you know, if they take an overdose of birth control pills or whatever.
Right.
In fact, birth control pills or emergency contraception cannot cause a miscarriage. And in fact, women who are prone to miscarriage are sometimes given progesterone, which is the main hormone in birth control, to sustain their pregnancies.
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
Yeah,
I knew that the day after pill that prevents pregnancy was used some of the ingredients of birth control pills.
It's a high dose of birth control, and it's only effective before you become pregnant. Once you're pregnant, you're going to stay pregnant.
Well, you're defining pregnant as
birth control or emergency contraception.
Right. You're defining pregnant as implantation. What that pill does is prevent implantation. Okay. Kelda, thank you for correcting me. As I said, this is not my area of expertise. It's not, you know, my concern is that we've got a bunch of male legislators sitting around saying, let's figure out what's best for women. And that just harkens back to the days. I mean, it wasn't until the 1920s that women even had the right to vote in the United States. It wasn't until the 1970s that women had, you know, any protections in the workplace of any consequence. And really, prior to the 1900s, women were legally the property of their husbands. They couldn't sign wills. They couldn't sign contracts. That, you know, if up until the 1880s, if a woman's husband died, the court appointed a male to determine what would happen to her estate, where her children could go, and they could be taken away from her. Her male executor would determine what religion her children were raised in. I mean, this is the history of the United States that I think most people forget. So, Kelda, thank you for correcting me on that. I appreciate it. We, like I always say, we have the smartest listeners, in the business. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
There's also a big financial status in this whole abortion thing, because poor women go to Planned Parenthood or a clinic similar to that for an abortion.
Right.
Wealthy women, the daughters of the privileged and politically connected, go to their gynecologists for a therapeutic D&C to correct irregular menstruation.
Now, do they still do that? I mean, when I was in high school, abortion was illegal, and I knew a number of women, a number of girls at that time, 16, 17-year-olds, who had DNCs, and the excuse was always, I have irregular menstrual periods, but kind of everybody knew, wink, wink, nod, nod, that this was terminating a pregnancy. It was very common among women who could afford it to go to college, or to go to the hospital. Is that still happening?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and if it's coded correctly, the insurance will pay for it.
Huh. Amazing. Amazing. So when are we going to criminalize DNC? Because I thought DNCs were a procedure that had been kind of relegated. This is dilation and curettage. Is that how it's pronounced? It's basically opening and scraping out the inside of the uterus.
And that's how you do an abortion.
Yeah, which takes, if there's an implanted embryo in there, it's going to take that with it along with the lining of the uterus. Fascinating. So what you're saying, Chris, is basically these laws only hurt poor women.
Exactly.
Yeah, which takes us back to we have two criminal justice systems in the United States, one for rich people, one for poor people and working people. Apparently we have, two sets of abortion laws in the United States, too, or policies. Chris, thanks for the call. We'll be back. It is 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in the case of El Salvador, it's fairly well documented. Most of these women who are in jail for having miscarriages did nothing to try to induce those miscarriages. Welcome back. 5 minutes before, 15 minutes before the hour. And Dave, watching Free Speech TV in Armstrong Creek, is it Wisconsin or?
Yes.
I got the W here. I've got to reconfigure my my call screen software so I can.
Wisconsin.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So what's up?
Anyway, on the abortion issue, I think everyone should have the right to have children, and women should have the right to choose to have an abortion depending on the circumstances of the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there should be more emphasis put on comprehensive sex education,
yes,
access to birth control.
Right. We know that reduces abortion rates because it reduces unwanted pregnancy rates.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody wants to see abortions for convenience sake, but, sometimes...
Well, hang on just a second, Dave. There are women who get pregnant who know that if they continue with that pregnancy, this is typically much younger women, that they're going to have to drop out of college, that they're going to have to quit their first job, that they're going to have to interrupt their life in a way that they may not economically recover from for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
And I think that a woman in those circumstances, if she's in a very early stage of her pregnancy, should have every right to get an abortion.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you there for sure.
And that's for convenience. Convenience is too casual
well,
a term,
I
but
guess
that's,
I guess
you know.
I meant it in a different way.
Yeah. I think what you meant is frivolous, right?
Right, right.
Like, just for the hell of it. No, I don't think any woman gets an abortion just for the hell of it. I've known a lot of women throughout my life who've gotten abortions, and I don't know of anybody who just said, oh, yeah, I think I'll go have an abortion. That sounds like fun. Afterwards, let's have a beer. No, it doesn't work that
anyway,
way.
Anyway, also I'd like to say that the Republicans seem to be hell-bent on putting Planned Parenthood out of business. And really, abortions are a very small part of what they do.
Less than 1%.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, they make it sound like, well, Planned Parenthood's all about abortions.
Right.
Really.
Right. Most Planned Parenthood clinics don't even offer abortion services. They merely refer you to abortion services. There are very, very few. I'm not sure that there are actually any that are run by Planned Parenthood. There may be. But just the fact that they refer it out is enough to make it all to make these guys all hysterical.
Yeah, and I hate the term abortion doctors too, because they're really they aren't abortion doctors. They're just
gynecologists
to perform a procedure. You know.
Yeah, they're gynecologists. They're surgeons who work with a woman's reproductive organs. I mean, that's which is and increasingly they're women, which I think is a great thing for other women. I always wondered about a man who at the age of 22 would decide he was going to spend the rest of his life looking up women's crotches. What kind of guy makes that decision? But that's a whole other conversation, I guess.
Well, thanks, Tom.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call, Dave. I appreciate it. But it does raise an interesting question. This used to be entirely male-dominated. I mean, there was a time up until fairly recently, actually, when even having a midwife was outlawed. There was a time up in my lifetime, up until the time I was maybe a teenager or thereabouts, where it was nearly impossible for a woman to get into medical school and much less become a gynecologist. I mean, it just didn't happen. You know, I remember back in the 70s, the newspapers would have the help wanted ads, help wanted women, help wanted men, help wanted women, secretary, maid, help wanted men, doctor, lawyer, right? I mean, it's whatever it may be. Anyhow, we'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Catherine in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Let me give you a little background on our personhood bill.
In Wisconsin?
That jailed a woman when she was pregnant. Phyllis Schlafly backed Congressman Grossman in his bid to go to D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So he is in D.C. He's one of the primary people with the personhood bill. He's eliminated sex education in Wisconsin. He wanted to have a bill passed that all single parents are potential abusers and must register with social services, but he didn't get away with that one. He did get away with equal pay for women going. So now we have the personhood bill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It was a young woman who had never been pregnant before, had a thyroid condition and depression, and she was self-medicating with drugs. But then she suspected she might be pregnant. So she went to the EAU Claire Wisconsin Hospital.
I think it's Eau Claire, but anyway, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
For pregnancy, right? So she submitted to your analysis, and she thought they were getting her drug, right? And she disclosed her past drug use. They were reporting her to the authorities. And it turns out she was 14 weeks pregnant, and they had her jailed.
Wow.
They made her take another pregnancy test. They put her in solitary confinement. They threatened to tase her, all of which could have caused a miscarriage, and then she would have been accused of murder. She is now permanently on the child abuse list as a child abuser.
Right.
It's become a civil rights thing. She had to agree to more tests periodically to even get her out of jail. And she was held for 17 days without any prenatal care, and she was subjected to abuse and harassment.
That's insane. And not only that, one of the things that we know about pregnancy is that the child, the fetus is constantly interrogating the mother about, am I going to be born into a dangerous world or a safe world? And if the feedback loop that tells the fetus that is a chemical called cortisol, a hormone called cortisol that adults produce when they're under stress. And so if mom is under stress during her pregnancy, particularly the first 3 months of her pregnancy, when the primary decisions about the nervous system of the baby are being made, then if there's a lot of cortisol in her bloodstream, the fetus will develop with a larger hindbrain, the fight or flight response, and a smaller forebrain, the intellectual, thoughtful, empathetic response. Whereas if there's low level, because it's going to be born into a fight or flight world, so it needs to be a warrior, right? Whereas if a child is, you know, gestates in a womb that is not filled with cortisol, then you get more forebrain development, less hindbrain development, and you get a baby that is more intellectual and less physical. And, you know, the kind of abuse that this woman was subjected to is going to affect the baby that she gives birth to. And I mean, that's medical science 101. I mean, that's astonishing. That's astonishing. Catherine, thank you for sharing the story with us. That's nuts. Jill in Milwaukee. Hey, Jill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to remind you all that South Korea, it is illegal also for abortions. And but they still are performed. Just, you know, it's a matter between the woman and the doctor and if she can afford it.
Right. So it's
and moment of conception is considered. Well, they're like a year old when they're born there, too.
Oh, interesting. At the date of birth, you're considered 1 year old.
Right, right. So they kind of think that it's you're a person already, you know,
yeah.
A moment of conception or whatever. So
yeah.
But if they are still performed there, it's kind of just not talked about.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question to ask a right to lifer. Is, you know, if when the moment the baby is born, it is not 9 months old. Why is that? But
right.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Jill, although, you know, the older we get, I think the less likely we are to say, hey, let's add 9 months to our age. Jill, thanks a lot for the call. That's fascinating. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, a lot of these Republicans are very disingenuous when it comes to abortion because there are, you know, mostly what happens, the reason that people have women have spontaneous abortions is that you know, they're exposed often to things in the environment that cause the fetus to abort. And many of those things are substances that they refuse to regulate or ban.
You're right. You're right. And if they don't cause abortion, I think is too strong. If they don't cause miscarriage, if exposure to toxic chemicals doesn't cause miscarriage, and we know it does. I mean, look at this is one of the things at Love Canal that was one of their early indicators.
Well, you know, the thing is, though, it in a sense, the baby is lost and it's a loss. I mean, if you really support life, you know, you have to be consistent.
Right. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. I'm with you. Totally. Thank you, John. Thank you for the call. Dan in Albuquerque, listening at KABQ. Hey, Dan.
Yes, I just wanted to correct a previous caller. I'm in the medical field. Well, I've called before once in a while.
Okay.
But I just wanted to say that, yes, in high enough doses, estrogen can complicate pregnancies or even cause a miscarriage. So there are cases of that.
Okay, yeah. I thought I had read about women, you know, using overdoses of birth control pills and how dangerous it is.
If you do that, I mean, normally, you know, obviously, most people that are taking the daily pill, they're not going to have those kind of problems. They'll more likely to have other common side effects, right. Bloating and other things. But all.
But please do not use this as a self-help guide, because an overdose of birth control
pills is a lousy way to
even if it might occasionally produce an abortion, it's a lousy way to do it.
I didn't intend that.
Yeah, no, I know you didn't. I just, you know, having had it said on the airwaves, I feel a responsibility to say that.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
okay.
Dan, thanks a lot. You know, a voice from the field of medicine. Thanks a lot for the information. We just have 15 seconds before the break, so not enough time to get in another call. But, and what's going on today? Oh, well, I've lost my one sheet, but. In any case, we will continue in just a few minutes. There's a lot of other stuff I want to talk about. The Progressive Change Committee has come up with the PCCC. What should be the progressive agenda? I'll share some of that. The five Republican worst lies on inequality. Anna Porter, who has been on this program in New Mexico, is documenting this whole loan shark thing for poor people. It's amazing stuff.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
I don't have my one sheet. We don't have any more guests, right? Okay. Cool. I'm going to have to dig it out. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. And the five worst Republican lies about income inequality. This is a great one by David Morris over on the Commons. He says, number one, the Republicans say income is not all that unequal. Actually, David Morris writes, since 1980, the income of the bottom 90% of Americans has increased a meager $303, or 1%. And by the way, that's household income. So, and now, nowadays, you know, back in 1980, the average household had 1.3 or something like that, people working. In other words, mostly it was a single person household. Now it's in the neighborhood of 2, and in some cases higher than 2. Excuse me. Got the hiccups here. The top 1%'s income has more than doubled, increasing by about $500,000. And the really, really rich, the top 0.1%, they saw their income quadruple to $22 million a year. So the 0.1% get $22 million, the 1% get $500,000, and the bottom 90% get $300. Yeah, income, you know, but the Republicans say, nah, income's not all that unequal. In fact, full-time workers' wage is 11% lower than in 1973. That's Reaganomics at work. Number two, inequality doesn't matter because in America, ambition and hard work can make a pauper a millionaire. It's folklore. The Brookings Institute says, quote, there is growing evidence of less intergenerational economic mobility in the United States than in any other rich industrialized country. The fact of the matter is, before Reagan became president, America was one of the top five countries in the world in terms of if you're born poor, you can end up wealthy. And it was in the top, as I recall, top two in the world of if you are born poor, you can end up in the middle class. Now we are at the bottom of the pile. If you're born poor in the United States today, odds are you will die poor. And if you are born rich, odds are you will die rich. And if you're in the middle class, odds are your and your children's income will continue to decline. Why? Because of 35 years of Reaganomics. It's that simple. It is really just that simple. Number three, the Republicans say income inequality is not the result of tax policy. Right. Nonsense, says David Morris. Painstaking analysis by economists Thomas Piketty, Emmanuel Saez, and Stephanie Stentevich found a, quote, a strong correlation between the reductions in top tax rates and the increases in top 1% pre-tax income shares from 75 to 79 in 2004 to 2008. For example, the U.S. slashed the top income tax rate by 35%. That would be during the Reagan era. And witnessed a large 10% increase in its top 1% pre-tax income share. By contrast, France or Germany saw very little change in their top tax rate and their top 1% income shares during the same period. In other words, France and Germany did not do Reaganomics. They still have high taxes on rich people. Their rich people are not as obscenely rich as our rich people, and their poor are not as poor as our poor people, and their poor are more likely to end up in the middle class, and the middle class is strong and vibrant. Number four, the Republicans say you tax the rich, you're going to slow economic growth. Again, nonsense. An examination of the 18 OECD countries, these are the wealthiest countries in the world, found, quote, little empirical support for the claim that reducing the progressivity of the tax code has spurred economic growth, business formation, or job growth. In fact, you know, Thomas Piketty, you know, his book Capital in the 21st Century, big deal. He says the without slowing economic growth, the income tax rate on the top earners could be as high as 83%. Recall it was 74% before Reagan came into office. Reagan took it down to 28%. Mark Zandi, chief economist for Moody, says a dollar in tax cuts on capital gains adds 38 cents of economic growth, whereas a dollar in unemployment benefits gives the economy a boost of $1.63, and a dollar in food stamps adds $1.73 to the economy. So you want to stimulate the economy? Stop giving tax breaks to rich people. That actually diminishes economic activity. Start giving more people food stamps and long-term unemployment who don't have jobs. Or even better, make the government the employer of last resort so everybody has a job. Tighten up the labor market, which will drive up wages. And number five, taxing the rich would not raise much money. David Morris says, of course it would. If only the 400 richest families, whose income in 2008 was an astounding $270 million, actually paid the statutory rate of 39%, an additional $500 billion would be raised over 10 years, which would put a substantial dent in the projected deficit. He adds, in 2010, hedge fund manager John Paulson made $5 billion. That year, according to Pulitzer Prize winner David K. Johnston, Paulson paid no income taxes. Let me repeat that. John Paulson made $5 billion and paid no income taxes. Right. Anna Porter, who's been on this program a couple of times, her new daily New Mexico loan fact, she says 52,800 New Mexicans took out unsecured installment loans with an average interest rate of 486% during 2013. The average borrower spent $968 to repay a $547 loan. There are 59,600, people say, oh, this is rare. No, there's 59,600 of these secured installment borrowers in New Mexico. And New Mexico is not a particularly big state. This is one of the most profitable businesses in America, is basically ripping off poor people. It's obscenely profitable. And, you know, poor people don't have the means or the ability to fight back. The Progressive Change Committee did a survey. They asked people to vote on what should be the progressive agenda for the United States. And I'm curious your thoughts on what should be the progressive agenda. What is it that we should say to whoever is the Democratic nominee, and, of course, to every Democrat running for political office in the United States? These are the things we want you to campaign on. What should we say? Over 1 million people voted on this, and here's what it comes down to. And I know I presented part of this last week, or maybe earlier this week, but I want to go through it again because I think it's brilliant. Number one, expand Social Security. Don't cut it, expand it. Number two, corporations are paper, not people. Right? Strip corporate personhood. Number three, tax equality. That means that everyone pays into the Social Security trust fund the same percentage. Do away with the cap. Number four, decentralize the funding of political campaigns. We have fewer than 200 people who provided about half of the half a billion dollars that went into super PACs last year. That's nuts. That's oligarchy, not democracy. Number five, end the oil depletion allowance. No more subsidies for the oil industry. Number five, restore Glass-Steagall. Yeah, you think? That was number six. Number seven, single-payer health care. Number eight, break up Citigroup and all the other big banks, I would add. Number eight. Number nine, do not allow corporations to shelter from tax profits in foreign subsidiaries. You know, this is Apple's big scam, but it's not just Apple. It's pretty much every major corporation in America is doing it. Number 10, expand the post office. Number 11, rebuild our decaying infrastructure. Number 12, an emergency program to provide unemployment for everyone in need of a job. In other words, make the government the employer of last resort, something I've been pitching for 10 years on this program. Number 13, Make gerrymandering of districts illegal. Number 14, bring back the WPA to build roads and bridges. Number 15, dismantle the private for-profit prison industry. Number 16, reinstate the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court gutted. And number 18, allow all Americans to enroll in Medicare.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Single-payer health care for everyone. What do you think? 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. You know, what would you add to the progressive list? Or have we pretty much nailed it all? I mean, there's the list goes on beyond that. But Terry in Silver Springs, Nevada. Hey, Terry, you wanted to get back to the abortion laws.
Well, yeah, I had a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
I want to use your quote, too. I love this. Is this the camel's nose under the tent to Sharia law, all this stuff that they're doing?
Yeah, the Christian version of Sharia law, certainly.
Since I'm not a Christian, does the Bible address abortion?
It does. If a man strikes a woman in a way that causes her to abort, he has to pay her husband a certain amount of money. And I'm forgetting where that is. I'm pretty sure it's either in Leviticus or Deuteronomy. It's part of the rules, you know, for conduct. So there's that. You know, it's been a while since I've looked this topic up, or we've really done abortion on this show, and so I don't have the list in front of me. And then in Genesis, of course, God breathed life into Adam, and in several places throughout the Bible, they refer to the breath of life or the first breath. The theory for the first, say, 1,000 years of Christianity being that a baby becomes filled with the spirit. In other words, their soul enters their body at the moment of birth. That, you know, but now we're in the realm of theological debate, not science. So.
Okay, and then I just wanted to give one little tiny bit of advice to men who don't like abortions.
Mm-hmm.
Choose wisely.
Yeah, there you go.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Terry. And I'd say the same to men or women. You don't like abortions, don't get one. Mark, watching Free Speech TV in Gladstone, Michigan. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I want to put a plug in for The Crash of 2016, just an excellent read.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's just out in paperback.
I'm going to be buying one to pass around up here in Escanaba area.
Cool. Thank
you. The other thing is TPP, is there anything in the Constitution that stops Fast Track? And if Fast Track isn't in the Constitution, like I don't believe it is, isn't it possible that Mike Papantonio or one of these big law firms could possibly take this to federal court and challenge it? Because TPP gets passed. I've been fighting this for 2 years now up here, and it's finally taking hold.
Yeah.
If TPP gets passed, it's a death spiral for America, and people are ignorant to what's going on around them.
I absolutely agree with you. I think we're already in a death spiral as a result of NAFTA, CAFTA, and the WTO, you know, back from the 90s. But the first of all, the Constitution says that treaties with foreign countries, which would include, in my opinion, and the opinion of many actual constitutional scholars, would include trade agreements, are negotiated by the president, but have to be debated in the Senate and then require a two-thirds vote of the Senate, 67 votes, in order to pass the Senate. What Fast Track does is it short-circuits that debate, and it makes it a straight-up-or-down vote. So the way that I think TPP is unconstitutional is that it should be considered a treaty rather than agreement, and instead of putting it to the House and Senate for an up-or-down vote, it should go to the Senate for debate and consent, you know, for advice and consent, number one. Number two, The Fast Track Authority, which says that there can be very limited debate, just minutes of debate, and no amendments, all that kind of stuff, that's actually legal. That falls under the rules of the House and the rules of the Senate, and they can write their rules in a way that allows them to conduct themselves any way they want. The Constitution does not say how they have to conduct themselves. In fact, it explicitly says they can make up their own rules. I would say, though, that this is a treaty. Thanks a lot, Mark. Here with you, Jack, in Kingman, Arizona. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I love your show.
Thank you.
And I really think you're brilliant. When they talk about fetuses feeling pain during an abortion, Do you remember when you were circumcised and how painful it was? I don't think anybody does.
I don't remember it, no. And I am circumcised, and I think it happened roughly around the time I was born. I was born in a hospital. It was not a religious circumcision. It was, my parents were Christian. But it was just at that time everybody did it. So, but you, what's your point?
You just really feel pain. I mean, you were talking about tactile.
Oh, that I experienced pain when I was circumcised, but I don't remember it. So what's the big deal? Is that what you're saying? The response to that would be that the circumcision didn't kill me, whereas an abortion does kill, stop the continuing growth. I think kill probably qualifies. For whatever it is that's growing in a woman at whatever stage of pregnancy it may be. So
I think it's a ridiculous argument anyhow.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a ridiculous argument too. And in fact, you know, years ago, this book, The Secret Life of Plants, plants react to pain. You know, it's not like they have a nervous system that reacts to it, but there's a biological reaction. You cut a plant, it will freak out, or you poke it with a needle or give it an electric shock. Jack, thanks a lot for the call. Jim, not to compare us to plants, but hey, you know, we're all living things. Jim in Lancaster, Kentucky. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hello, Tom, sir. How are you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. Jim, how about you?
Doing great, sir. I was just wanting to add an idea for the Democratic Party platform.
Okay.
How about the legalization of cannabis, both industrial hemp and, you know, medical cannabis? Because the polls are trending that way, that there's a clear majority of Americans now that are for both things.
And, yeah, that's a great suggestion. That is a great suggestion, and I think it's something the Democrats could campaign on. It's a very good suggestion. Thank you very much for that, Jim. Great to hear from you. Bernice, listening to 1260 AM in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Bernice, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's Bernice. I think I didn't hear anything mentioned about education in the economic stimulus type things, the Democratic agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, one of the biggest economic boosts is to make sure that all of our public schools are fully funded, and that the social services that we also provide in schools must be fully funded.
Yeah.
And also, I would add on to that, community college fully funded. And some better help for four-year college attendance, because there is such a, I think it's a 1-7 return on any dollar put into education.
Yes.
That
in terms of tax dollars.
Like correct.
Yeah, in terms of economic stimulus, it's massively greater than that. And as
well,
we learned,
true, yes.
You know, with the GI Bill, I mean, the GI Bill was the thing that set up this explosion of innovation in the 60s, 70s,
right.
and 80s in the United States.
Right. And that GI Bill, for those of us in you're in my generation, you know, that set up this upward trend in mobility and economic mobility for our parents. My parents were dirt poor.
Yeah.
The GI Bill helped, you know, get us into an upward trend. And I know it did for millions of others. And to the point where I always thought that our salaries were going to get better and better. And, you know, since 1981, they took a different turn.
Yeah.
But, so there's a lot to look at with education, I think.
Yep. Completely agree with you. And I think four-year college should be free, too. We need a new GI Bill without the GIs. We just need to say, you know, if you could go to college, you can go to college. Bernice, as most developed countries do. Bernice, thank you. Excellent points. Bob in Marseilles, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Bob, what's up?
And it is Marseilles. We can't speak French here. But
there you go.
The reason I called is a statistic you quoted Monday, which kind of goes with things that you're talking about today. And it had to do with the trade deficit. And it was either 7 or 17% that you were quoting, I believe. And what I was wondering, you said that this is a big part of our problem, and it is. And things like TTP, judging by what happened with the Korean and Central American and NAFTA agreements, it's not going to help. But what I was wondering, if that statistic was a little bit more like our unemployment figures that don't count underemployed people or people that gave up. And
right.
Basically, is that counting as part of our GDP? All the financial junk that we ship overseas.
Yeah.
Because if it does count that financial junk, isn't that 7 or 17% actually so understated that it's pitiful and not worth even considering as a valid statistic?
Yeah, A, it does count as part of our GDP. B, our trade, the way the trade deficit works is when we buy more stuff than we sell to other countries, those countries end up with a bunch of dollars that they can only spend here in the United States. So they come to the United States, but we don't manufacture anything. So there's nothing they can buy from us that's manufactured. So instead they buy our buildings, they buy our businesses, they buy our roads, they buy our electric systems, they buy our water systems, they buy our infrastructure, they buy anything that's not nailed down and a lot of the stuff that is nailed down. They buy a lot of our land. And so the statistic that I cited is that 1/7 of America is now foreign owned. And, you know, when you hit the point where it's like more than 50%, then you are really, legally a colony of some other country. And this is what we used to do to other countries. We would go in and we would buy their productive farmland. It was called Banana Republics. You know, the United Fruit Company used to come in and buy up all kinds of land. And they'd end up being the largest landowner in countries like Nicaragua or Hawaii, actually. Dole Pineapple, you know, owned large chunks, and the sugar companies owned large chunks of Hawaii, which led to ultimately the integration of Hawaii as one of our states. But this 1/7 of America being foreign-owned, I've got to track that number down where it originally came from. I've seen it quoted 2 or 3 times, but I've never seen the original raw source. So don't take that as gospel, but I would bet that it's that or it's very close to it. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Our trade deficit really and truly is the deficit we should be hysterical about, we should be concerned about, and nobody wants to talk about.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And then the reason nobody wants to talk about it is because these insane, disastrous, stupid, insipid trade deals were promoted by both Republicans and Democrats. They're all hiding it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. There's some nuance with regard to the conversation that we had day before yesterday, I think it was, about helicopter kids and bubble wrap kids. That was day before yesterday, wasn't it? Yeah, it was. It was Tuesday. And actually, let me share this first story with you, and then I'm going to come back to that, and then I'll pick up your phone calls. WXYZ, which is a Detroit radio or television station, is reporting that over 11,000 rape kits. This is where when a woman comes into a hospital or a police station and is sent to a hospital, and says, I've been raped. They take a swab and presumably get the rapist's semen, the DNA, and then can identify the rapist, right? Over 11,000 sexual assault kits, some dating back to the 1980s, were found abandoned in a Detroit police storage facility back in 2009. Not long after the rape kits were discovered, the Worthy, I don't know who Worthy is, this is an excerpt from an article, started to push to start processing with the Michigan State Police. So far, 1,600 rape kits have been processed. It's just a fraction of them. A little more than 10%, resulting in the in identification of about 100 serial rapists and 10 convicted rapists, according to Worthy. Worthy told reporters the perpetrators had moved on from Michigan to commit similar crimes in 23 other states. So this is a big deal. I mean, you know, the police don't take these rape kits seriously. With regard to our conversation 2 days ago about helicopter kids, I did get one email from a parent, and I discourage you from sending me emails. Most of them don't get through to me anyway because my spam filter has a whole long list of political words. And if you're not in my contacts list and any of those words appear in your email, it just, boom, goes right into spam. And I hate having to do that. But, I get hundreds of emails a day from listeners, and I just can't, I wouldn't have a life if I had to read them. The best way to talk to me is to call, right? And in fact, I encourage you to. But this one woman said that back years ago, that she said that she thought that I was being arrogant and snotty, talking about how parents are helicopter parents are bubble wrapping their kids and not letting them experience life. And she talked about how she was walking her child home one day, and some scuzzy looking guy in a crappy old truck pulled up and said, hey, lady, how do I get to so-and-so? And she just knew this guy wanted to steal her kid. And so she started running with her kid. He followed her for a while, yelling, how do I get to so-and-so? And she ultimately either yelled the instructions at him or didn't. I don't remember which. And she kind of ends the story with, I saw him driving off in the direction that he said he was going to go, but I knew he was there to steal my son or daughter. And I just, you know, for the record, the vast majority of children who are molested, abused, raped, fill in the categories, because that's what this woman was writing about, happen at the hands of close relatives. The vast majority are older brothers. After older brothers come stepfathers, fathers, and cousins and uncles, other close relatives. After them come family friends. And among the strangers who abuse children, by and large, they do not look scuzzy and weird. They look like upstanding citizens. Many of them are in every other dimension of their lives, which is why children trust them in the first place. Or they are, and you know, I know personally of cases where this has happened. They are people who work in the house. I know of a plumber that raped a child. And the child did not talk about it for years because the plumber told this child that he would murder her parents if she said anything. I mean, that's typically how it happens. It's not some creepy looking guy who pulls up on the street asking for directions. In fact, typically a creepy looking guy pulling up on the street asking for directions is simply a creepy looking guy who doesn't have much money, who's looking for directions. So, I mean, let's order our priorities here, and let's understand where the real dangers to our children come from if you want to be genuinely careful about it. So I just couldn't let that go without responding to it. People have been so indoctrinated by the whole Adam Walsh. You know, I mean, the number of kids who are abducted by strangers in the United States on an annual basis is around 130. That's very rare. It's smaller. It's much smaller than the number of children who are accidentally killed in their own homes by their parents' guns because they found the guns and they killed themselves by accident. I don't have the number for that, but I know it's way more than 200. So your child is far more likely to be killed by a gun in your home or in a neighbor's home than to be abducted by, you know, one of these bad guys like poor Adam Walsh's or John Walsh's son Adam had happened to him. So let's keep our dangers in perspective. You know, it's just like 9/11. You know, we go crazy over things that are not big dangers. The odds of dying in a terrorist attack in the United States have always been, including the year of 9/11, less than the odds of dying in a lightning strike. And at the time of 9/11, Bin Laden only had 5,000 followers in the world. And he needed publicity to get more followers. And the best publicity he could have, Bin Laden could have, would be if George Bush would start killing Muslims in the Middle East, which George Bush, of course, obligingly did. Which you can draw a direct line from George Bush in his decision to respond to 9/11 with two stupid and illegal and frankly criminal wars, and the murder of hundreds of thousands of Muslims, and the displacement of millions. You can tie a direct line from that to ISIL right now, threatening to cut the heads off a couple of Japanese workers and all the other horrors that they're visiting. You can tie a direct line from that. Well, actually, you could tie a direct line from the incompetence of the Nigerian government to Boko Haram. You know, you have commentators like Bill Maher out there saying Islam has a problem with their fundamentalists. I don't disagree with that. But it is the thinnest piece of a very thick problem. Prior to 2001, there had never been a suicide bombing in Afghanistan or Iraq in their histories. And Iraq has a history that goes back 7,000 years. As a continuous civilization, it's the cradle of civilization. It's where Ur was, Ur and Uruk, which are the city and the state that Gilgamesh wrote about in the Epic of Gilgamesh. Most of these people, they will cite Islam as their justification. They'll say they're doing it in the name of Allah. But really what's going on is they feel that people of a different religion have come and killed them for religious purposes, and so they're using their religion to fight back. This is about criminal acts of war committed by George W. Bush and Tony Blair. Did you see where the Chilcot report? I read this on BBC yesterday. I should have printed it out. The Chilcot report, which is investigating how Tony Blair lied to the British people about 9/11, sexed up the dossier. Remember that phrase? In other words, making the threat of Saddam Hussein look worse than it was a non-existent threat, making it look like a real threat. The Chilcot report was supposed to be released, and they have put it off until after the British elections. Labor is breathing a sigh of relief. Labor are actually, you know, the liberals, the good guys, but Tony Blair was a Labor president. And when this Chilcot report comes out, I predict it's going to say, just like the report that Dianne Feinstein recently released, you know, that these guys, that the Republican administration here in the United States and the Labor administration, what would be a Democratic administration in the UK, the Tony Blair administration, lied to their people and participated in war crimes. And again, we don't order our priorities, just like people are overly hysterical about their kids being abducted, or whatever, you know, or they're directing their attention in the wrong place instead of looking at friends, family, and neighbors as potential molesters of their children or whatever. They are instead looking at the stranger driving down the street, and we, as you know, looking at dangers. I mean, we have 50,000 people a year who die as the result of the use of alcohol, and I'm not even talking about drunk drivers. We have 450,000 people a year who die in the United States as a consequence of using tobacco. And we're hysterical about 3,000 people who died on 9/11. And by the way, since then, every single year, the majority of people who have died at the hands of terrorists in the United States have died at the hands of right-wing terrorists. And others who are not Muslims, as opposed to Muslim terrorists. Our media has this whole thing totally out of whack. We are completely missing the boat. We need to have some rationality in this, but our media has no interest in feeding us rationality or delivering rationality to us, because we don't have news anymore. We have infotainment. And the whole mission of news shows these days, there's a piece in the New York Times today about Megyn Kelly and Fox. You know, Fox is making over $1 billion a year now. Why are they making $1 billion a year? Because they're scaring the hell out of people. They're delivering infotainment. As are all the networks. We need to, you know, some rational conversation around real risks in this country.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Pardon the digression from all the other things that I'd planned on talking about today, but anyway, we'll be back. Welcome back. It is 15 minutes before the hour, and Sue in Morgan, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Sue, it says you want to disagree with me about children and dangers. Go for it.
First time ever in my life I'm going to disagree with you, Tom.
Well, I'm not always right.
Well, let me tell you why. I have 25 grandchildren and 16 great-grandchildren. I grew up Catholic. I lived a very sheltered life, walked to school every day, and I lived in an area of a Pittsburgh suburb where there was no school bus, and we had just moved in that area, And I was on my way walking to school, and normally I might possibly be walking with one of my younger siblings. I'm the oldest of seven, but I was walking alone. I was in third grade, and the car pulled over and kept at me, trying to get me to get in the vehicle. Right. It just so happened that our friends lived in the home that I was right next to on that road at the time, and I ran there. I have stories like that for my children, my grandchildren, and my great-grandchildren. So if we don't explain balance of this for all of the circumstances that you talked about, we're not doing the right thing.
Oh, I absolutely agree. Every child in America should be taught from the time that they can understand, don't talk to strangers. I don't disagree with that at all.
Okay, but I mean, I believe that that it's much more dangerous today than it was back then, and I'm 66, so, but it was dangerous back then, too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, our propensity for violence in this country has gone up dramatically. I know you know that, and I do too. And we used to watch Walt Disney and Old Yeller and all of this stuff. No. We're watching violence constantly.
Yeah, no, I get that, Sue. But if you look at the statistics on sexual abuse, and they've been around for a long time, one in three women and one in five men have been sexually abused at some point in their lives. The vast majority come from an older sibling or from a stepfather or father or a cousin or an uncle. It's almost always men who are the perpetrators, and that's where the vast majority of it comes from. We need to educate our kids about that just as much as we need to educate our kids about look out for strangers.
I concur, but we need to let them know about the strangers because...
No, I'm not saying we shouldn't. I'm just saying that I think that we have a national hysteria about strangers when we're not looking at the most likely cause of these kind of things, which is friends and family. So, Sue, maybe we don't disagree, but thank you for the call. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Luke Vargas, live from the United Nations for the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And there's new news, by the way, on Don Siegelman's plight. Go to free-don.org and check it out. Hey, Luke, what's going on at the UN?
Hey, good afternoon. It's been a pretty busy day here. Things got underway this morning at the General Assembly, where they held their first ever meeting to talk about the rise of global anti-Semitism, quite a topical theme for debate in light of recent events, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say only that this is the first time that the General Assembly has ever talked about this issue, which is sort of remarkable to think about. It's worth noting this meeting was called for before any of those attacks in Paris, the hostage situation at that Jewish grocery store. This was back in October that 37 countries wrote to the UN to say they'd like a meeting on this topic. We heard, understandably, from the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, Ron Prosor, who is a very good speaker when he's even talking about rather mundane topics, but was very eloquent today. He was basically issued a direct challenge to European leaders. He didn't talk too much about the Middle East, about issues pertaining directly to his homeland, but he did talk about Europe a lot, saying that the world had pledged never again, but here we are again with violent anti-Semitism casting a shadow over Europe. And he said that European leaders need to stop just memorializing dead Jews from European history and do more to make life better and safer for those who are still living on the continent. So his focus was very clearly on the situation in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, which, you know, as it's interesting that what tends to provoke this kind of thing is economic crisis. These are both bad leading indicators.
Yes. Just to continue one or two more points about this meeting, I'll note that the U.S. Ambassador, Samantha Power, also delivered remarks. She acknowledged that there is are current issues in Europe, but she said this is not just a European issue. I heard you citing some statistics to your last caller before I came on the air, and I've got one that Samantha Power shared with us, that she said the FBI has found that even here in the United States, two-thirds of crimes directed at people because of their religion are directed at members of the American Jewish population. So she's obviously trying to widen the focus here, say this is not just about Europe, but it's an issue we are still struggling with here in the United States. And I found that statistic to be quite startling. It's something I hadn't really taken much time to think about until she mentioned it.
Yeah, I would have assumed after 9/11 that two-thirds of hate crimes directed to people based on their religion would have been Muslims, you know, who would have been the victims.
I would have had the same assumption.
So we still have the white supremacists and the skinheads going after Jews.
Evidently so. She didn't elaborate more than that, but those are statistics I would be interested to dig into a little bit more and find out the nature of those attacks. If you permit, I'm going to skip around a few issues.
Go for it.
That I've been watching very closely. We have a little more information now about the status of those negotiations between the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, Roberta Jacobson, and her Cuban counterparts. These are, I believe, they're four-day talks that began yesterday in Havana. Again, we're getting a better sense of the issues that are emerging as sticking points, and these don't really seem all that surprising to me because they've been kind of at the heart of Cuban issues with Washington for quite some time. Chief among them is the U.S. migration policy that we call wet foot, dry foot, essentially, that if a Cuban migrant can make it onto U.S. soil, they are then opened up to a whole bunch of legal proceedings and a potential route to citizenship or asylum in the United States. It's an issue that Havana has been upset about for so long because they say it's a magnet for Cubans to leave the island, that this policy should be dropped and that they should not be allowed to have any sort of special protection in the United States. What we've been hearing from U.S. negotiators there is that there's no willingness on the part of Washington to rethink that strategy. We've heard there's some leniency, perhaps when it comes to taking the Cuba off the state-sponsored terrorist list, that we're going to work with them on establishing an embassy there that they can approve of. There's that famous incident.
Right. As long as we have that policy, we're basically encouraging the Cuban government to engage in repressive policies against their own citizens, because if they were to say, okay, anybody who wants to go to America can, then the cream of the crop, you know, the best and brightest of Cuba, their doctors, their lawyers, whatnot, would begin immigrating to the United States immediately, because so many of them, A, have relatives here, and B, the economic opportunities are so much better. That seems like in the context of normalizing relationships, something close to an insane policy. It's a policy designed to destroy another country.
Yeah, you may be right about that. Again, though, it looks like there is not flexibility on the part of the U.S. to rethink that.
I think that's a temporary tip of the hat to the Marco Rubio crowd.
We'll see. Some of the issues that we've been hearing, there is more agreement on, and these sort of make sense. That's the establishment of regular commercial flights between the United States and Cuba. Talk Radio News is looking into sending me down there pretty soon. It turns out that the first flights from New York to Cuba on these charters will begin in March, which is sort of news in and of itself, but those are not straightforward commercial flights like many people are expecting to start seeing. And then banking relations. You'd heard the president talk a number of times recently about how Americans ought to be able to go to Cuba to use their Visa cards, their credit and debit cards. Currently, that is not allowed. Technically, it is allowed now. It's just that the relationships between the banks don't exist quite yet. So there's work, evidently, on getting those things settled.
Yeah, although that shouldn't be that big a deal, because Europeans use their credit cards in Cuba routinely, and Canadians do. So the infrastructure is there. It's just a matter of getting the American banks wired into that, which shouldn't take that much time.
Yeah, I think you're right. And then I'll say the final thing we're hearing that the U.S. really wants to see some progress on, and that I'm not surprised has become a sticking point, is the Internet. You know, as I've learned in my research, there are only a very small handful of hotels or facilities in Cuba that have regular access to the Internet, something like three hotels. So the U.S. really wants the spread of the Internet there. They see it as an important democratizing feature in the country. Cubans are resistant on that.
That's interesting.
That USAID scandal last year about...
Yeah, we'll see where this goes. Luke, we're out of time, but thanks so much for reporting from the UN for us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, now back. Now I want to get to the topic that I wanted to start the first hour with today, which is John Boehner a traitor? Is it possible that by inviting a foreign head of state to speak to a joint meeting of Congress to lobby for a piece of legislation that will affect that foreign nation and may affect the interests, both political and financial, of the Republican Party, that John Boehner has committed a crime that may even rise to the level of sedition or treason? Can you imagine if John Boehner had invited Vladimir Putin to speak before the United Nations, to speak before the assembled members of Congress about the Ukraine crisis? Or if he had invited the president of China to come and talk? Everybody would be hysterical. Can you imagine if when the Democrats controlled Congress, if when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House and Hugo Chavez was still alive, and I think they overlapped, if she had invited Hugo Chavez to come address the assembled delegates of the House and Senate, the United States House of Representatives, the United States Senate, to invite Hugo Chavez to come and speak on whether or not the United States should become a more socialist nation, right? Whether or not we should nationalize our oil industry the way that Venezuela did. Can you imagine how you know, not just Republicans would react. Everybody would react. It would be considered insane. Well, John Boehner has invited Benjamin Netanyahu to address a joint session of Congress without running it through the White House. Article 2, Section 2, Sentence 2 of the U.S. Constitution makes it very clear that foreign policy is the province of the president, and that after the president negotiates treaties with foreign nations, they are approved by a two-thirds vote in the Senate. John Boehner is not even in the Senate. He's in the House of Representatives. So there's a variety of possibilities under which you could call this sedition. B, you could say that, although sedition is conduct or speech designed to incite people to rebel against the authority of a state. Arguably, he's not asking people to rebel against the authority of the state, of our state. Although, you know, the authority of the state is to conduct foreign policy. We're talking, you know, he wants Netanyahu to lobby against Iran, to lobby against the president's negotiations with Iran, to put more strict penalties and I mean, John Boehner is like the American equivalent of the Ayatollahs, you know, the hard right fringe in Iran, which doesn't want America negotiating with Iran. And then you got the hard right fringe in the United States that doesn't want America negotiating with Iran. Another option is back in 1799, President John Adams was very upset about the fact that a number of members of Congress had traveled to France or were corresponding with the French and discussing things like American foreign policy, or for that matter, American domestic policy. He considered this a violation of the law. The Logan Act, which was passed in 1799, makes it a felony, 3 years in prison, to negotiate with foreign governments. And I would argue that this is a form of negotiation or an attempt to influence negotiation, to negotiate with foreign governments, quote, without authority. Now, the Logan Act doesn't define what without authority means, but certainly when John Adams was president, this was passed, and it is still the law. The authority was assigned by the president because the president is given authority over foreign policy in the Constitution. Now, it's also possible that John Boehner's in violation of the Federal Elections Commission law, the FEC law. Section 441E of the FEC law makes it illegal for a person to solicit, attempt, or receive a contribution or donation from a foreign national. Now, it implies money, and Netanyahu presumably is not coming and handing John Boehner $1 million. But how is political support not a contribution? So this may be a violation of the FEC law. Section 441 also makes it illegal for, quote, a foreign national directly or indirectly to make a contribution or donation of money or any other thing of value. To make an express or implied promise to make a contribution or donation connected with a federal, state, or local election. Now, A, if Netanyahu's showing up and the Republicans inviting him to speak before the House is going to help the Republicans in the next election and his speech is a thing of value, then Boehner has clearly violated FEC law, which is a felony. And for that matter, you know, Netanyahu has now postponed his arrival and his speech back a month to March, 2 weeks before the Israeli elections, which raises the question, is this sort of a reverse FEC thing? Is John Boehner helping Netanyahu get reelected in Israel when he's facing a serious challenge from the left? And then none of that addresses the fact that this is just a massive disrespect of this president. Can you imagine if Congress invited Khrushchev to come to the United States and address the UN when Jack Kennedy was president? Or even an ally, if Congress had invited Charles de Gaulle to come address the United States when Jack Kennedy was president. I'm pretty sure they were both alive at the same time. This has never been done, to the best of my knowledge. In fact, there's a quote. This Guy Ziv, a professor at American University who studied U.S.-Israeli relations, he told TPM, "This is unprecedented. It's hitting below the belt. It's taking partisanship to a whole new level." Now, I would be inclined to say that, you know, Boehner wouldn't do this to a white president. This is such a massive sign of disrespect. But after what the Republicans did to Bill Clinton, I'd say at least they would never do this to a Republican president. So the question is John Boehner a traitor? Should he be prosecuted under the Logan Act? Should he be prosecuted under FEC law? Should he be just, you know, brought up on ethics charges in the House of Representatives? Now, of course, that's going to require the Republican Ethics Committee to make that decision, which obviously isn't going to happen. But should it happen? And then if John Boehner goes to jail, are they going to work out some kind of deal where, you know, he's only in jail for a certain number of hours every day so that he can still hit the bar every day? Or will Congress suddenly appropriate money for a new club fed where they've got a bar in every cell? I don't know. Merlot along with dinner? But I kid. I mean, you know, but this is a serious issue. Inviting a head of state to come lobby for a piece of domestic legislation, even though it involves foreign policy, it's domestic legislation. This is a U.S. law we're talking about. And we're inviting the Prime Minister of Israel to come and lobby for it. This is wrong. It may be seditious. It may even be treasonous.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do you think? How should the president deal with this? How should we deal with this? So far, John Kerry is just kind of shocked. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Sandy in Center, Alabama, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Sandy, what's on your mind?
Hey. Well, just comment right quick on your subject. I haven't heard about this. That's the first I've heard about it. But that's crazy. Somebody's going to stop this.
No. Nobody has the authority to.
John, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, Boehner wouldn't he?
The president could stop it, couldn't he?
Not without creating an international incident. If the president was to say, no, we're not going to let Netanyahu come into the United States. I mean, Netanyahu is going to be here anyway for the APEC conference. Pretty much the only way the president could stop it would be to pull his visa, and that would be a disaster for U.S.-Israeli relations.
Yeah, I get that. Well, I don't think Boehner come up with this idea all by himself. You know,
yeah, I agree.
I bet you one of his billion-dollar contributors, who's Jewish,
probably Shelley Adelson.
That's who I'm figuring. Unless the Koch brothers, I don't know what Koch is, if it's Jewish or not. But
yeah, I don't know where the Koch brothers stand on.
He didn't come up with it by himself. I mean, he ain't smart enough for that.
Israel is Shelley Adelson's number one issue. In fact, when Chris Christie made the mistake of referring to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict using the wrong exact phrase, he had to go back and apologize and kiss his ring and bow down and kiss the ground and all kinds of stuff. I mean, it was insane. So, anyhow, you wanted to talk about the economy and the minimum wage?
Well, yeah, a little bit, because I'm so tired of hearing these Republicans talk about how the only people making $7.25 are the youngsters and people for a second income. I'm 59 years old, and I'm making $7.25 an hour because there are no jobs paying any more than that, probably within a 100-mile radius of where I live. I live in Alabama, which is one of the poorest states. But, you know, I made $10 an hour when I started working 30-plus years ago.
Wow.
So it's pretty demeaning.
Can you live on $7.25 an hour?
The only reason I can get by with it is because I'm on disability, so it's a kind of a supplemental income for me. You know, I just work, a certain number of hours, but I see everywhere I go in different places and fast food restaurants, pharmacies, there's a lot of elderly people over 55 working for minimum wage. So that's just somebody's not doing their homework on that deal.
Well, I think the reality is all fairly clear. It's the Republicans like it this way. You have a disempowered electorate that's freaked out and afraid. They're less likely to vote. They're certainly less likely to be politically active. And the Democrats are trying to do something about it, but the Republicans control the House and Senate, so they can't. So the Democrats can't do anything. I mean, you know,
Alabama, I believe, is one of the states that tried to finagle the voting regions,
yeah,
the districts.
Oh yeah, pretty much every state has done gerrymandering. The only state to fix that, I think, is California. They fixed that a couple of years ago, and it's really helped the state. But
And just one other thing, real quick. I was watching the Senate yesterday, and I caught him right in the middle of a vote on an amendment bill. I'm not sure what the main bill was, but it was on climate change, and the amendment was saying that climate change was.
They said it's real, but they wouldn't say it was caused by humans. So, Sandy, thank you for the call. Past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Is John Boehner a traitor? Interesting question. Strong language, obviously. But this is, you know, is he a traitor or is he just massively disrespectful both to our president and to the office of the presidency? I would say if you just watched his face and his body language during the State of the Union address, he's certainly massively disrespectful. Anyhow, time for a pigeon alert.
Da-da-da. Look, up in the sky.
It's a bird.
No, it's a plane.
We are autonomous robotic organisms from the planet Xenu.
And now, a story about a bird.
Right. What happened in November of last year was a bunch of pigeons were showing up in Vietnam, and they had markings, letters on their wings. And the Tha 9 news website reported this, that they were spies. Everybody was hysterical about it. 16 of the pigeons were trapped by locals and handed over to police. They thought that these pigeons were spies from China. Turns out that they were apparently racing pigeons, or at least that's the cover story. I think they are spies from the planet Xenu. So that's our pigeon alert for the day. Jerry, in Spring Lake, North Carolina, you have some thoughts on Speaker Boehner and Prime Minister Netanyahu? Jerry?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
How are you doing today?
I'm great. What's up?
Well, I was surprised that you picked up on it because that's what I was trying to call you about, was the fact that what Boehner has done is extremely disrespectful, but it's another thing. He's abrogated his oath to office. He's supposed to be supporting the Constitution and the offices that are related to the Constitution.
In fact, the president in his speech, he said, my job is to defend the American people. No, your job, the oath of office you took, is to defend the Constitution. And the same is true of John Boehner. In what way is John Boehner not defending the Constitution? Is that because the Constitution gives foreign policy to the executive branch?
That's right. Yeah. And the other thing is that he's inviting a foreign entity to come in and make policy in the United States on our domestic issues. It might be something if it was about, forming a group to retaliate, a war and so forth, which seems to be what the Republicans are aiming for. They want another big war so that they can distract everybody from the collapse that you've been talking about.
Well, also so that all of their war contractor buddies can make, $1 trillion more and hand it off to them in campaign contributions.
Yeah. We've been a war-based economy for a long time, even though they'll tell you, well, no, this is not, you have to have this much production and this much and everything. But when you look at economies scales, man, if we didn't have the defense industry, a lot of our economy would be in shambles.
Yeah, we've been a war-based economy since Vietnam, and arguably since World War II, but in a big way since Vietnam, and it's not a good thing.
Yeah.
Excellent point, Jerry. Thank you for calling and making it. Joanne, in Gettysburg, South Dakota, you have some thoughts on Congressman Boehner?
Yes, I certainly do. I think that he is an absolute traitor. And if at least the Democrats ought to boycott his speech, if he's allowed to come and speak before the House and Senate, the whole Senate ought to boycott him, and the Democrats in the House ought to.
Yeah.
Just leave him talking to those traitorous Republicans.
Well, if you have thoughts on this and you want to talk to your member of Congress about it, or for that matter, Speaker Boehner's office, the number for the switchboard at Congress, which will all you have to, it gets you to all 535 members of the House and Senate, is 202 202- 202-225-3121. And I don't know if we've got a Chiron. We can put it up on the screen, but it's 202-225-3121. And thank you, Joanne, for that. Thank you very much. David in Woodland Hills, California. Hey, David, you wanted to go back to our first hour talk topic about the personhood bills?
Yes, but in answer to your current question, most Republicans are guilty of treason. I have a quick statement and then a quick question.
Well, wait a second. How so? I mean, that sounds hyperbolic. How can that be?
The way they've treated the president, the way they've held down the economy for the vast majority of Americans, all of their entire political outlook and everything they do is up against the people. And
yeah.
and
back to the caucus room conspiracy here.
Yeah, everything they do, it's either sedition or treason.
Yeah, yeah, I would say
anyway,
certainly sedition. Yeah, go ahead.
About that woman in jail for being pregnant, I'm so concerned about the chipping away of probable cause in America. Imagine you're born the son of a bank robber, and you're labeled a potential bank robber from the day you're born.
Right.
It seems like that's where we're headed. The question I have for you is, Obama during the his speech.
Hang on just a second, if I may, just to that. The situation right now in the United States, or not right now, but the situation that the Republicans are trying to set up with these personhood bills is that every woman, once she reaches the age of fertility, once she has her first menstrual period, is a potential criminal. And these bills basically criminalize being a woman. Back to you, David.
It's the chipping away of probable cause, which is all over, and it's against the Constitution. But Obama asked for the unilateral right to attack our enemies. It sounds Bushian. What does that mean?
You're talking about his authorization for ISIS?
To go after ISIS? In the State of the Union.
I think that was the constitutional scholar in him. He is going after ISIS right now. He's bombing ISIS in Syria and in Iraq, and he's doing so based on the on two different laws that were passed during the Bush era, the authorization to use force in Iraq, which has not expired, and I don't believe, and another one, and I'm forgetting which one it is. And what he's saying is, if we're going to go to a war against a whole brand new enemy, Congress, you should authorize it. He was really putting Congress on the spot with that, saying, you know, you guys have the obligation to define what is and what isn't war. I actually thought that was a good thing. I'm not sure I agree with the policy, but throwing it in the lap of Congress is what he should do. David, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And only a few, Shano points out, only two people applauded it because Congress is all like, what? You want us to take responsibility? What? No, no, we don't do that. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Tracking Iowa. And they're showing snow in England. Is this the winter storm that went up the East Coast? They've given a name to it now, and it's whacking Europe. I'm just seeing the Chiron on CNN. Anyhow, Kevin in Dedham, Massachusetts, you wanted to apparently disagree with me about my concerns about what John Boehner is doing?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about Boehner bringing in Netanyahu, but no one had a problem with David Cameron. You know, Obama brought him in, and he admitted...
Hang on just a second, Kevin. The job in the Constitution, the job of foreign policy is that of the president. And once he negotiates foreign policy, it gets approved by the Senate. John Boehner is in the House of Representatives, and the president inviting a foreign leader to the United States is perfectly normal. The Logan Act was passed in 1799 because John Adams was so upset about members of Congress negotiating with foreign leaders. It made it a crime. It's 3 years in prison.
Well, President Obama's having David Cameron call members of Congress and the Senate.
You're
splitting hairs here. I mean, we're all mad because Boehner is trying to get another view, but you're not mad because David Cameron is on the side of Obama, so now he can start calling. you don't have a problem with
the Wait a minute. Are you telling me that David Cameron is calling and lobbying individual members of the U.S. House and Senate?
Yes. Yes. He said he admitted
is that a fact?
That he admitted that in
the in support of what?
That's what he said he was doing.
I can't hear you, Shane.
He said he was calling people
yeah.
to tell them about the deal.
About what
he
deal?
He admitted it.
About, yeah, Shane, I can't hear you. Oh, about the Iran thing. Oh, okay. So now the president has David Cameron calling to basically oppose what Netanyahu's going to say. Oh, geez, this is a mess. Our caller dropped off the line. That might even be a violation of the Logan Act, too. I don't know. That's interesting. I was unaware of that. But I still think that this is wrong. I just think it's wrong. Mark in Minnetonka, Minnesota. Hey, Mark, what's up? Mark, you're on the air. No, Mark. Andy in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Andy, thanks for listening to 880 AM. What's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Well, I'm not sure about the legal aspects of all this, but I strongly agree with the comment the woman made earlier about boycotting the session. You know, it would be wonderfully dramatic if all the Democrats from both houses stood up and walked out on Netanyahu when he's introduced, but that would be tacky, too, and the Democrats have too much class.
Well, and it would be political suicide Jews and members and supporters of Israel and fundamentalist Christians in their districts.
But I think what they should do is simply all Democrats from both the Senate and the House should simply refuse to show up that night. Because
yeah.
then it would not be a joint session of Congress. It would be a joint session of the Republicans.
That's interesting.
And both houses. And I think Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid should call their members together and say, look, this is a purely political act by the most partisan political group in history, the Boehner Republicans.
Yeah.
So let it be a partisan event. Let them invite Netanyahu to address the Republicans.
Yeah,
we won't be there.
I'm with you. I don't think this is the most partisan Congress in history. Although this last Congress passed fewer bills than the first Congress under George Washington.
Whether it's the most partisan in history or not, it's certainly up there. But I mean, just saying, let force their hand on it by saying we're not going to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be. I don't disagree with your sentiment, but knowing the politics in this town, I don't think that anybody wants to be. And I don't think most Democrats. I mean, Israel's our ally. I'm astonished that Netanyahu would accept the invitation. I mean, I think this is very bad judgment on his part. But that said, I don't think that any Democrat wants to be seen as dissing the Prime Minister of Israel. Particularly at this critical time. I mean, we also have negotiations going on with Israel, and we're, you know, we give them $3 billion a year in foreign aid, too.
That's why the Democrats lose elections, because the Republicans would have no hesitancy about slapping anybody in the face if Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid had done anything of the sort. They would have gone all out.
It would have been scorched earth.
And the Democrats won't stand up and call the Republicans out on their partisan moves.
Yeah.
They need to.
Yeah, good point. Andy, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening there in Asheville. Mark in Chicago listening to CPT. Hey, Mark.
Hi. I was watching your TV program from yesterday, mm-hmm. and it seemed to me that what I often think, that we're losing a lot of debates because we're not framing the issues right and we're not using the right language.
You're talking about my lone liberal debate last night on TV?
Right, with Ullman and the other one.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I think that, like, Citizens United, for example, they frame that as a free speech issue, okay? When actually it should be framed as the opposite. It's suppressing free speech. It's really when you make free speech dependent upon how much money you have, the right to free speech, then what you're doing is you're suppressing the free speech of everybody who's not a billionaire.
Right, you're essentially legalizing bullhorns.
and bribery and bullhorns, you know, bribery and, you know, and essentially, you know, it's like you become free speech is not a, then a basic right. It's a privilege. It's a luxury of the well-to-do.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, it's so what it is really a willful suppression of free speech. So to make free speech inaccessible to most anybody who's not a billionaire.
Yeah.
So it's really a suppression.
Excellent point, Mark. You should have been in our production meeting when we came up with the questions and topics for last night's debate. Thank you for that. And that's a great reminder. I'll try to remember to use that next time. Thank you. Pat, listening to KTNF in Star Prairie, Wisconsin. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm a recovering alcoholic. I've called your program many times over the years, especially during when Bernie Sanders is on the air. But I can tell you from being around a recovery program for well over 30 years, John Boehner, it's a well-known fact. The man has a serious drinking problem.
Yeah, he's a high-functioning alcoholic. I mean, that's...
You took the words right out of my mouth, Tom.
Yeah. In fact, Bob May devotes several chapters in his book, Sideswiped, to John Boehner's drinking problem and his criminality problem, frankly.
And, you know, Tom, this I would not be surprised if he contacted, you know, the premier of Israel in a drunken stupor, and not even out in a drunken stupor, because if we've drank for every ounce of alcohol we drink, it takes an hour to detoxify, Tom.
Right.
So if he's been drinking all day, say, and he's put the equivalent of an hour, I mean, a quart or a liter of alcohol in his system, he's literally intoxicated for 2 to 2.5 days after that. It takes that much time.
Wow.
If you've been drinking for several days, it takes weeks and months. That's why they generally detox centers have a general detox time of 21 to 30 days. And it's just, this is the work of a chronic alcoholic, high functioning, the words you use. And just, I hope you get this message out that just when is somebody, where is Jim, the former the recovering alcoholic from Jim Ramstead? I went to school with his brother in St. Paul, Minneapolis at a Catholic high school, Jim and Bob Ramstead. Jim was the former congressman that helped so many recovering alcoholic and drug affected people in the United States Congress and Senate.
Huh.
Where is this guy when we need him now?
Yeah, yeah. Somebody needs to do an intervention with Speaker Boehner. Pat, thanks for the. Although everybody's afraid to, because he just, you know, he wields power like a sledgehammer, and he's got a lot of money. My personal theory is that one of the hard right pro Israel billionaires, and I'd put probably Shelley Adelson at the top of that list, has their hand in this somehow. And if that's the case, and this is going to lead to a donation to Boehner from that billionaire, then it's a clear violation of clearly the FEC law and then maybe even the Logan Act. Pat, thanks for the call. Excellent perspective. Matthew in Springfield, Virginia. Got a minute to the break, Matthew. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to talk to you about, you were talking earlier about foreign companies buying up America.
Yeah.
The hour ago. I think one of the most blatant examples of how a lot of foreign companies now have senators in their pockets. You look at Dick Shelby in Alabama with the Toyota plants, how he wanted to throw GM and Chrysler under the bus in the midst of the bailout, mainly because it would bring more money to Toyota.
Right.
I think that's something that's very dangerous going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely agree.
There's another example. If you look in Tennessee, he raved about the Nissan and Volkswagen plants. But if you read an article in the Post from about 8 months ago, there was a Nissan worker saying, you know, the Spring Hill GM plant is where everyone wants to work, which is unionized.
Right. Right. But the politicians, and this is a kind of cross politician problem. I'm with Bernie Sanders that any state that offers incentives to any corporation to move from one place to another, to move to their state, should lose all their federal highway money. We should basically ban this kind of practice. But on the other hand, these foreign companies would not have the money. They would not have the dollars to buy and build factories in the United States if it wasn't for our trade deficit, which is the result of our insane trade policies. Great points, Matthew. Thank you for calling. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And coming up in a little bit, Kai Newkirk from 99rise.org. And welcome back. Skip, watching Free Speech TV in Ashfield, Mass. Hey, Skip, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Just get you off the speakerphone. Yeah, I was just thinking about that news report that you had there about the anti-Semitism is up and everything.
Mm-hmm. In Europe.
And I was kind of thinking that maybe people are confusing their hate for the Israeli government for their hate, you know, for their hate for the Jewish religion. You know, Israel is doing terrible things to Palestinians and deserve much hate, I think, the government.
Well, hate is the wrong word. I think maybe censure. But, Israel, with regard to their policy, with regard to the Palestinians, and particularly the Gaza Strip, I don't think are helping themselves when it comes to anti-Semitism across Europe. But I don't think that you can blame anti-Semitism on Israel. Anti-Semitism has been around as long as Jews have been around, and it's an evil and ugly thing, and it can be a very slippery slope to start saying, oh well, anti-Semitism is happening because Israel is doing this. It's not Israel that a lot of these folks are going after. It's just plain old good old fashioned Jews, you know, just particularly those who are visibly Jewish because they're wearing a kippah, or if they're Orthodox, Chassid, they're wearing the whole, you know, the old 19th century Polish outfit. So, I got the message, Skip. Thank you for the call. Pam in Seattle. Hey, Pam, thanks for watching Free Speech TV online.
Hey, and I have a whole thing I wanted to talk about, the stranger and, you know, anxiety of walking with your kid. I had a lot of experience, but now you're on to this other important topic to me because I have family that lives in the occupied territories. And it seems to me it's time to stand up and say, well, John, we want Israel to be responsible. We're giving them $3 billion a year, and what they're doing to the Palestinians is completely unacceptable. I know most people don't understand. There are all these neighborhoods that have been created in the Palestinians' territory where we are funding the creation of the building of houses. We're supplementing families' incomes, and these are Jewish kids, basically very young families that go over there. We're paying for it all for the Israelis to make them basically cannon fodder.
Yeah, the Israeli settlers. Yeah, I have friends who live, Jewish friends who live in the West Bank. And in fact, Louise and I have stayed at their home.
About. I'm talking about settlements. And we've got family living there. They thought, you know, they're very seriously became Orthodox Jews so they could live there.
Yep.
And it's an absolutely horrible environment for our young, for our grandchildren that are there, and the stories that I've heard from what their lives are like, it's crazy. And
I think it's a radicalizing environment.
Yes.
You know.
And we're supporting that, and people have to understand that. So this would be the opportunity, I feel like, to say, we want to see Israeli be responsible. If we're going to continue to fund them at the rate we are, $3 billion a year, to build settlements, no, this has got to stop. They have got to stop the settlement building. They have got to make peace with the Palestinians.
Yeah, I think that there are some parallels. This is apartheid, you know, some parallels with South Africa. Pam, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Kai Newkirk is here with us in the studio, progressive organizer and co-founder of 99Rise, 99rise.org. You want to welcome Kai?
Good to be here. I want to say happy birthday to my mom.
Okay, cool. Happy birthday, Kai's mom. Tell us about 99Rise first, and then I want to get to Citizens United.
Well, we're fighting to end the big money corruption of our democracy. Like many are in our country, and we're using the weapon of nonviolent civil resistance to do so.
And were you participating in the event over at the Supreme Court yesterday?
Not yesterday. There were 7 true patriots who went into the chamber of the court, and one by one, in a dignified act of nonviolent civil disobedience, stood up and spoke truth to power against corruption to defend our democracy, following the example that I set last year.
Do you know if they were arrested?
Yes, and they're still in jail right now, the Supreme Court 7 that we're calling.
Really? What were they arrested for?
Well, they gave him the same charges that they gave me last time. 3 federal misdemeanors, we think, basically all essentially for the same thing, for speaking out within the court. They call it making a harangue. But there may be an additional conspiracy charge this time.
Wow. Wow. So they're facing serious time. I mean, conspiracy is what, 5 to 20 years?
I'm not sure. I don't think so. I think they're going to be fine. But we need people to stand with them. You can actually go to 99rise.org and sign a petition to stand with the Supreme Court 7.
Great. And what else is 99rise doing about this? Yesterday was the 5th anniversary of the Citizens United decision.
That's right. And I think, you know, it was one of the worst decisions in the court's history, clearly.
Oh, I think it's the mirror image of Dred Scott. Mm-hmm. Dred Scott said people are not property. People are property, excuse me. And Citizens United said property is people. I mean, it's a mirror image. And Dred Scott led right to the Civil War. And I think that Citizens United is leading right straight to aristocracy, to oligarchy.
Absolutely.
And I don't know that it has the potential to create a civil war, but it certainly has warped our democracy.
No doubt. I mean, we don't want to just go back to the days before Citizens United, right? We're in the era of super corruption after Citizens United. And 5 years is enough. And that was the message that we were in the court to bring. But we believe that we're not going to win this fight unless we follow in the tradition of the abolitionists, the civil rights movement, the women's suffrage movement, that used the tool of nonviolent civil disobedience to make business as usual untenable until there was change. And that's the example that we're setting through this action. But now we need to do that at a mass level.
So what do you have coming up? And
well,
how can people participate?
That's right. That's right. So many people were inspired when I stood up alone in the Supreme Court, and many more now that 7 have done that. But we need something that's not one, that's not 7 people, that's hundreds, thousands. And we're planning now, potentially, in the early stages, I won't make a promise, but to organize mass civil disobedience here in the Capitol, to shut it down if necessary, to force change. And if people are inspired by that vision, we want them to go to 99rise.org and sign up to be part of it.
Wow. Now, in this era of bizarre hyper-reaction, are you concerned that what you're doing is a criminal conspiracy?
You know, we in the nonviolent tradition stand
on the conviction
of our acts. You know, we just celebrated a national holiday for someone who went to jail like 35 times in their life, right?
Yeah.
So we see this as something that's not a mark of shame when you go to jail for justice. It's a badge of honor. And it's something that everybody who loves our country should be proud to do. And especially at this time when everything that we value, the people, the places, the principles that matter to us in our country are at risk.
Mm-hmm.
If we continue to live under a government that represents just the 1%, not everyone, if you care about our country, if you love your country, it's the time now to step up and be willing to do whatever it takes to reclaim our democracy.
What is the if 99rise was totally successful and we hit the end result that you're shooting for? What mm-hmm. is that? What would it look like? What is it?
Well, we would say it's a real democracy that's based on one person, one vote, not $1, one vote, where we have genuine equal citizenship, equal political equality, where everyone's voice matters as much as anyone else's in our elections and our government, and we feel that we need a constitutional amendment to do so, and additionally federal legislation. And it has to meet the test of separating wealth and state, of establishing political equality regardless of wealth. And we feel that it most likely needs to address corporate personhood, establishing that money is not First Amendment protected political speech, and that Congress has the right and the power as the representatives of the people to regulate political spending to ensure political equality. Other additional anti-corruption measures like shutting the revolving door between government and business and establishing for some kind of decentralized public financing, so that makes the funding of our elections not an exclusive money primary that the 1% participate in, but part of a general election process that's open to everyone.
Right. So in other words, right now we not only have a problem of the wall between church and state being breached, but the wall between wealth and state has been ripped down by this Supreme Court. Are you part
Absolutely.
Of the Move to Amend coalition?
We are allies. You know, I'm not personally myself. You know, I'm an ally and friend of many people that are part of it.
Yeah.
And we want to work with everybody in this movement. And our message, and to people that are working on this and to many of your viewers who I know or listeners who agree with us on this issue, is that now is the time where we have to go beyond signing petitions, right, or even just lobbying. or talking to our neighbors and our coworkers. We have to be willing to step up to make deeper sacrifices to show the urgency of this fight and to be willing to disrupt business as usual, to force this conversation to the front of the dialogue in our country and to force change.
Is there a specific action coming up that you want people to know about?
Like I said, we're looking at possible plans for the summer or the fall for a campaign of mass civil disobedience, potentially here in Washington, D.C., which is sort of the heart of the problem. And if people are inspired by that vision, like I said, go to 99rise.org. Let us know that you want to be part of it, because we need to know that there's enough people that are willing to step up that we can do something on a historic scale.
Yeah.
You know, everybody, so many people have seen Selma, right?
Yeah.
We need a Selma in our movement.
Yeah.
We need a Birmingham campaign in our movement. We need a Seattle World Trade Organization protest in our movement. And the time is now, in 2015, before the presidential election becomes a dominant narrative in our country. We have to change the political landscape so they're fighting on our terms.
I think you're absolutely right. Kai Newkirk, progressive organizer, co-founder of 99Rise. 99rise.org is the website. Get over there, check it out, sign up. And thank you so much for being with us these 3 hours. Don't forget, democracy, as Kai was just telling you, democracy is not a spectator sport. You've got to show up. You've got to participate. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.